Love Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
Welcome to another segment of Center Stage. On today's show, we will be talking with author Jonathan Maxwell, who wrote the most fascinating book about the Holocaust called Murderous Intellectuals, German Elitists, and the Nazi SS. After I began to read this book, I must admit I couldn't put it down. He's an excellent writer. His style is incredible, but just the information that was within the book was just something that I'd never thought about, because I had heard of the Holocaust in the past, but I never really thought about what the people, the Jews, went through. And this book just opened your eyes to just some of the horrific crimes that were committed during the Holocaust. And we're going to let my guest, Jonathan enlighten us a little bit more. Good afternoon, Jonathan, and welcome to the show.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. I think we're getting a kickback. I apologize for that. Tell my audience a little bit about Murderous Intellectuals. Give them a little insight as to what this book was about.
To begin, I'd like to say that I've always been interested in the Holocaust. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, I was in the living room. It was a Saturday evening. My father was a veteran. He had served in the military, and you know he loved all things military. And he was watching a World War II documentary. I don't think he was aware that I was nearby. I think I was on the floor playing jacks or something. But that night's episode of the documentary, it was about, you know, the Nazis' war against the Jews and other so-called, you know, undesirables. And I saw all the disturbing images, the crematoria, the piles of dead bodies. And, you know, being a boy, I was, you know, naturally horrified by what I saw. But at the same time, I mean, I was also intrigued. How can a civilized nation do such barbaric things? And that question just stuck in my mind, and, you know, I was never really able to get it out. I actually, read book after book about the Holocaust. And these were all great books, but at the same time, I realized that there was a shortage of information in regards to at least one aspect. These books would sometimes allude to individuals who were very well educated, very successful in life, and these individuals, you know, willingly joined the Nazi SS. This was the group that, you know, perpetrated the Holocaust, the persons who ran the camps.
So how do you think it was that, well, we'll go, I'm going to get ahead of myself if I go to this next question, so let me back up. Hitler was able to recruit people that we would say were more intelligent than him. So let's begin by telling a little bit about Hitler and his personality type. He wasn't a very good student,
No.
What I understand. He was average at best, and I think the subjects in which he excelled in were what? Were like gym and art, was that?
In art, yes.
So how is it that a man who was an average student and was not educated, did he even finish high school?
Oh, no, he didn't. And strangely enough, he received poor grades in German, of all things. No, he was a below-average student. And, he had, very little prospects in life. He tried to go to Vienna to become a successful painter because, he was, in fact, a good painter. But because he never finished high school, the local art schools in Vienna refused to accept him. And that made him very, very bitter. And on top of everything else, he couldn't sell his own paintings. And so, shortly after arriving there, he's a homeless person, eating in soup kitchens. And this is where he begins to hate Jews and other groups. It really wasn't because of any direct contact with any of these individuals. It's just the fact that so many people, such as Hitler, they look to other groups of people as scapegoats to explain their own problems, their own miseries. And I think, that was the reason why he decided to hate Jews and other groups, because he was looking, for a scapegoat. But in regards to attracting well-educated professionals, I think there were three things there were three ways that he attracted such intellectuals. One was because, he was such a you know, a dynamic, just wonderful speaker and oratory. He had a charismatic personality. You know, he seemed very fatherly, you know, at least to Gentile Germans. Another reason was because, you know, Germany was doing horribly. It had lost World War One. German citizens, they were hopeless, they were discouraged, and they're treated harshly by the Allies. They actually lose territories, and they're forced to pay enormous reparations and to dismantle their military. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the face of all this humiliation, Hitler comes along, who seems very strong, again, very fatherly. He claims to have answers, and he claims that the German people constitute the master race. So he appeals to their egos, and he claims to provide answers. And the last factor, I think, was just pure anti-Semitism or racism. Germany, like many other countries, you know, contained people who were anti-Semitic, who hated Jews and similar groups. And this transcended all, you know, boundaries in German life. Poor people tended to hate Jews, especially the poor people, because like Hitler, they were looking for scapegoats. The many middle-class people disliked Jews, and, you know, even members of the upper class hated Jews. Actually, it was quite anti-Semitism was actually quite prevalent in regards to the German upper class, because you know, they already had, you know, an elitist mindset. Many rich people, they do believe that they're better than other people just because of their material success or their, you know, their education. And
well, let me jump in right there. Hitler, from the beginning, let's establish he didn't have a bad relationship with the Jews from what we understood in his early life, correct?
Oh, no, no, absolutely not. There were many Jews who were actually, you know, tried to befriend Hitler. Back when he was growing up as a boy, the family had a Jewish doctor. Hitler was reportedly very, very close to this doctor, and the doctor would actually, you know, give Hitler and the rest of the family small gifts.
Mm-hmm.
In his homeland, in his neighborhood, his town, there were Jews who lived, you know, close by, but apparently he got along with them fine. When he was in Vienna, ironically enough, about the only patrons who purchased his artworks were Jews. And finally, in World War One, his Jewish commander is impressed with Hitler's bravery and even gets him a medal. So, you know, in this specific area, one realizes the contradictory nature of Adolf Hitler. Hitler, he didn't seem to operate on really a reasonable, rational, cognitive manner. He just tended to be driven by his own, you know, instincts. So
that said, when we look at Hitler's life,
sure,
you know, prior to him becoming what we last knew him to be, what do you think got things off track? How did Hitler become the monster that he became? What do you think the catalyst was?
I think being in Vienna, it made him very bitter. It made him very angry. And I do think that it turned him into somewhat of a sadist. He just seemed to have, you know, a hatred for certain groups, and it was a violent hatred, and, you know, it was just not going away. As far as Germany, what Germany, they went wrong as well.
Do you think his mother's death or his father being verbally abusive to him had anything to do with him becoming who he became?
Oh, sure, absolutely, yeah. Although it is very interesting that, you know, all people have problems and disappointments in life. You know, but most people, they accept those disappointments and they get on with life. It is very strange that, you know, Hitler came out the way he did. You know, again, all people have disappointments. But, you know, it's still a question that nobody can answer. He didn't accept the facts and just move on. It turned him into a monster. And, you know, his defeats in life, they weren't particularly remarkable. You know, relationships go bad. You apply to a prestigious graduate school and you're denied admission. You know, we all have disappointments like that. You know, the death of a family member. It's just very, very strange that while most people, you know, they overcome their emotions and their feelings, they go on with life. You know, Hitler, he never forgot these insults and these wounds. They just seem to, you know, fester within him.
So he never got past that. What kind of jobs did he hold prior to becoming Hitler as we know him?
He was a very, I guess you could say that there was very little stability in his life. He wasn't much of a worker. Much of the time he was unemployed.
Wow.
You know, we're talking about a very, very rootless individual. And, you know, despite all of his flaws, you know, Germany, they listened to him. I like to put the analogy this way, you know, from time to time, we're walking down a street, on a street corner, there's a man, you know, with a sign that says the end is near or something like that. And, you know, we instinctively, you know, fear these people or we want to ignore them because we think that they're mentally, you know, unstable somehow. And basically, Hitler was an individual like that, an individual who was rootless, just ruled by very base instincts, you know, someone who was very, very unsettling, but very sure of themselves. You know, the difference between Hitler and that man on the street corner was that millions of people started listening to him.
And that's very true. That said, when he was able to start recruiting, let's just say, it appears from reading your book that before he became the leader that we know him to be or last knew him to be, he started joining little groups, little hate groups, did he not?
Oh, sure, yes.
And is that where you think he found some of his following, you know, in those little groups?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And, you know, these groups, you know, they provided him for the first time in his life with, you know, friends, people who identified with him, people who expressed empathy for him. You know, all people have these emotional needs. They want to feel like they're loved and respected. And, you know, these were the individuals who decided to empathize with him, who decided to care about him, that he was one of them. You know, his entire life he had searched for a sense of belonging. And with these groups, you know, he found that. But the problem was that, you know, his new friends, you know, they were a violent people and had some very, very ugly ideas. And it is very strange because these groups from the get-go, they actually attracted, you know, members of the German upper class. Even at the beginning stages of the Nazi Party, you know, they were able to attract very successful individuals who donated a lot of time and a lot of money, you know, to these right-wing organizations.
So he rose through the ranks pretty quickly in those little groups, didn't he?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And a lot of that is because of his charisma and, you know, his determination.
So when he began to recruit these people to start his own army, if you will, do you think some mind control was involved, some brainwashing?
There was, yes, but, you know, at the same time, you know, these individuals, they were smart, they were resourceful, you know, oftentimes very successful. Yes, they were affected by the propaganda, but, you know, it wasn't like they were, you know, robots doing whatever Hitler told them to do. You know, they made choices. They made choices to hate Jews and other minority groups. They made choices to engage in violent acts. And finally, they chose to, you know, build these horrible concentration camps and kill, you know, millions of people. So, yes, propaganda, brainwashing, whatever you want to call it, there was an aspect there. Yes, it was a factor. But, you know, these were still individuals who knew right from wrong. And I think we always have to keep that in mind.
So give the listeners an idea of what type of professions we're talking about these intellectuals came from.
Oh, all the professions, you know, they were members of the Nazi Party. There was a death squad commander out in the Ukraine immediately following the invasion of the Soviet Union. This death squad commander, his name was Otto Wollendorf.
Mm-hmm.
And over a six-month period, he and his men shot down about 100,000 Jews. Now, this man was obviously a brute and a dangerous criminal, but he was also superbly educated. He had doctorates in both law and economics. Another death squad commander out in the Ukraine was Paul Vlobel. Over the course of 2 days, he and his men shoot down 34,000 Jews, and that is an enormous number, particularly since they were shot down over a two-day period. Again, Vlobel, like Ollendorf, was a very sinister man. He was also superbly educated. He was an architect. Another architect was Albert Speer. He came from the best European institutions, actually came from the German upper class. Despite all of his achievements, he fell very, very hard for Hitler. And, you know, he tries best to please him. Eventually, he becomes a minister of armaments, and he uses slave labor to build, you know, all this military equipment. These laborers were treated horribly. They tended to last about 2 months, and then they would die, either through beatings, starvation, you know, malnutrition, you know, whatever.
I think I read in your book that 90% of the arrivals were murdered, and only about...
Oh, absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, about 10% was selected to... to labor for the SS, whether as tailors or gardeners or doing assembly line operations. But keep in mind this 10%, you know, they didn't live very long either. They tended to perish about after 2 months. Another slave master was Dr. Robert Ley. Just a very, very brutal man, but he also had a doctorate in chemistry. There were many lawyers in the Third Reich. One such lawyer was Hans Frank. He was the general governor of Nazi-occupied Poland. He knew full well what was going on in the camps. Indeed, you know, he inspected the camps often, seeing whether or not they were, acting efficiently. And there was another lawyer, Ernst Kaltenbrunner. He was a security chief. He personally founded Mauthausen, which was one of the most brutal of the German concentration camps. I would say that about 50% of doctors were loyal members of the Nazi Party. Probably the most famous Nazi doctor was Josef Mengele. He came from an upper-class background. He had doctorates both in anthropology and medicine. Scientists who engaged in, you know, human experiments. There were about 200 other doctors that did that.
Yeah.
And the SS as a whole was a very, very well-educated institution. One-third of their officers had at least, you know, bachelor's degrees.
This I think was I was a- surprised to find that doctors would be actually monsters themselves and actually use these people sometimes as human guinea pigs. Explain a little to the listeners about how horrific it was when they did those types of things to the people. No anesthesia, you know, those types of ways in which they basically practiced science on human people while they were still alive.
Sure. But, you know, people often use the term experiments, but really and truly, you know, what it was just pure torture.
Wow.
You know, these doctors, they just had a morbid curiosity, and they hated their subjects, so, they basically tortured them to death. At Dachau, there were these scientists who organized all these freezing experiments, like they would take a concentration camp inmate, tie them up and then throw them out in the snow overnight. They wanted to see what would happen. But, you know, there's no mystery there. You know, obviously the person would freeze to death.
Right.
So we're not talking about any sort of scientific experiment that was, you know, actually based on the scientific method or that had any real reason. You know, it was basically just, you know, pure torture. Sometimes doctors would, you know, shoot a victim to see what would happen. You know, they wouldn't give them any sort of medical treatment. But, you know, the wound festered, and they were, you know, the victim was slowly, poisoned to death. You know, there was no mystery about what was going to happen. If you shoot somebody and don't give them any medical care, yes, the wound is going to get infected and they're going to die. So, you know, experiments, using that sort of term, it's not really a 100%, you know, accurate interpretation about what was going on.
They called it research, but it wasn't research.
No, it wasn't. No. It was basically sadism and, you know, and torture.
So when you think of the different ways, and this is the hard part of the interview, when I ask you to just elaborate on some of the different ways that they murdered the people in the camp. I mean, it was like incredible the creativity that was used.
Sure.
To do that. Give them an idea of what we're talking about.
Well, most of the victims, they were either gassed to death or shot. But, you know, the Nazis, they were always coming up with ways to kill, you know, their victims. Some victims, they were forced inside a synagogue, and the synagogue would be placed on fire, and, you know, the victims within the synagogue, you know, were burned to death. Sometimes victims were grouped together in large holes, and they were exploded, you know, using dynamite. Sometimes at the camps, this was especially sadistic, very difficult to read about. Sometimes, you know, victims were just buried alive. It was a very, very dark time in history. I mean, it was just a horrible,
Wasn't there a need at some point to dispose of some of these bodies? So what were the ways in which they used to dispose of the bodies?
That was always a problem for the Nazis because they were just murdering, you know, so many people. Early on, what the Nazis tried to do was gather together all the Jews in a town, march them off into a forest, have them dig ditches, and they would be placed into the ditches, and they were shot. And then the dirt, you know, was used to cover them up. The problem was that these massacres, and sometimes, you know, 10, 15,000 people would be shot to death over a 2 or 3 day period. The problem with that was simply that it was out in the open. There were always witnesses. And it really, really, you know, disturbed the townspeople, even if they didn't like Jews. And there were a couple of other problems. Sometimes oozing liquids that came from the ditches, they would actually destroy water supplies.
My goodness.
And, oh, sure, yeah. Well, you're talking about, you know, graves containing about, you know, 10,000 people. And sometimes the bodies, the corpses, they would expand in size, and sometimes the bodies would just come to the surface, and you know, and there would be witnesses everywhere. That being said, it was a very successful way of killing people, but they wanted to try a more secretive, you know, cleaner a manner. So that's how they got the ideas for the gas chambers, stationary gas chambers. They were in very, very isolated areas. There would be no witnesses coming around. And, you know, they were gassed and then placed in crematoria. And, you know, there would be nothing left of these people. When you had these mass graves, you know, the Nazis were always disturbed because they would never – you know, they would never decompose completely. With the crematoria, that solved their problem.
Wow.
So basically all traces of the murders were gone.
And, you know, I read in your book, which I found very sadistic, that some of the SS soldiers were so strange in their thinking or their behaviors that they took human body parts and made furniture and things like that from them.
Oh, yes. Whenever they went into the concentration camps, the inmates were shaved, and all of the hair were used to form pillows. And this is, you know, an especially gruesome aspect of the Nazi years. Fat was sometimes made into soap. At some of these camps, you know, some inmates, they had tattoos, and the tattoos were interesting to the Nazis. So, you know, the inmates were murdered, and the tattoos and the skin surrounding it carefully, separated from the rest of the body. And they would use the skin to create book covers or lampshades. It was just all very gruesome stuff. You know, it's hard to believe that it happened, but it did happen.
Wow, that's incredible. And let's talk about when these people were brought to the concentration camps. They were stripped of their valuables. What happened to their assets, their land, their money, their jewelry? What happened?
It was all supposed to go towards the, you know, to the German state. And this was one of the reasons why the Nazis, particularly the Nazi SS, just became so, you know, profoundly wealthy. You know, because they took basically everything from their victims, their cars, their jewelry, their furs, their clothes, their homes, their businesses. You know, like in Germany, you know, the Jews would be sent off to the east to the concentration camps. Well, guess who took over their businesses? Gentiles
what?
Did. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, one thing that was going on that was certainly not approved of was the fact that many of the members of the SS were actually embezzlers. You know, because with all the wealth around, you know, it was easy to do something like that and, you know, get away with it. Instead of putting jewelry into boxes going to, you know, Berlin, they would very quietly place the jewels in their pockets. And
wow.
So, you know, in this so-called brotherhood, you know, crimes like embezzlement and fraud, you know, just extremely common.
I mean, it's incredible that it happened. And why do you think it is it's so hard for so many people to talk about it?
Well, I think in part it's because of the enormity of the destruction. We're talking 2/3 of the European population just gone over a period of, you know, 12 years. You know, 2/3 of Jews, in Europe were killed, you know, by the Nazis or their, you know, allies. And, of course, it was a very depressing time, and a lot of people, they don't want to be reminded of that stuff. Yes, it's too unsettling, it's too disturbing. A lot of people, they'd like to think that people are basically good at heart, but when you read about the Holocaust, you remember that, you know, you're reminded of the fact that it's not that simple, that there are evil people around, always have been, probably always will. So it's just a very unnerving subject to dwell on. And, you know, even for me, someone who has always been interested in the Holocaust, you know, it was difficult for me to, you know, do all the research, the reading, and the writing, because it is just a very, very profoundly sad subject.
You know, speaking of that, what did they do with the women and the children and the elderly as they entered the concentration camp?
It's very sad, too. Children were always the first to go. Because they were too small to work. So, you know, if you were under the age of 13, as soon as you got off the trains, you were sent to the gas chambers. So, you know, the biggest victims of the Holocaust were, in fact, children. And babies weren't even spared. Sometimes German soldiers would just bash their heads in. On less common occasions, babies were just thrown into fires.
Wow. That's incredible.
And, yeah, incredible but true. The elderly, those too old to work, they were sent to the gas chambers as well. If you were a mother, most likely you would go to the gas chamber.
Mm. So weren't a lot of times the women, as they came into the concentration camps, weren't they raped as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely, sure. Supposedly, you know, it wasn't, according to, you know, the official SS policy, you were never to rape Jewish women, but it went on all the time anyway. And it further shows you that the Nazis, they weren't as ideological as, you know, as they claimed to be. You know, they would rape Jewish women. They weren't supposed to do that, but they did it anyway. And, you know, the more you read about the Nazis, the more you realize that not only were they evil, but, you know, they were crooked as well. You know, they stabbed each other in the back all the time. You know?
I believe when you get, you know, snakes bite snakes, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about, let's get into the soldiers. Some of the soldiers couldn't take the pressure, right? I mean, the killings day in and day out took a toll on some people, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, most of these soldiers, you know, they were raised in the churches, the German churches. Germany had always had, you know, a strong religious history. You know, that's where the Reformation took place. And so, you know, for centuries, most Germans were churchgoers. And of course, you know, in church, these young men learn that you don't harm women and children or older folks or the handicapped. You know, that just, you know, those were just terrible, terrible sins. And so they grew up with this. But at the same time, after Hitler attained power in Germany, these young men were just hit constantly by, you know, anti-Jewish propaganda. The Jews are evil. They need to leave Germany. If they don't leave, you know, let's kill them. And so there were always these two conflicts going on inside them. And, you know, obviously there's no way of reconciling, you know, one with the other. And because of all these stressors on them, a lot of these soldiers, they went insane. Some committed suicide. Some became severe alcoholics. Sometimes they even opened fire on their own, you know, their own fellow soldiers. It's very strange because the German government actually assisted these young soldiers in becoming alcoholics. And because of all the pressures of carrying out these jobs, you know, the German government decided to provide them unlimited quantities of free alcohol.
Wow.
And so because of that, they actually assisted, you know, many young men in becoming hopeless alcoholics. But, you know, that was just the nature of what they were doing. You know, drunkenness was always a serious problem in the SS ranks. Some drank before they started killing, some afterwards. And some actually drank while they were killing. They felt like that was the only way that they could carry out these deeds.
And weren't there some that were high in the ranks of the Nazi SS that couldn't even stomach the crimes being committed themselves? They kind of hid out in their offices?
Oh, sure. They stayed in their offices. And they actually looked down on the individuals who were, you know, carrying out the acts.
Mm.
You know, again, the SS always claimed to be a brotherhood, but it really wasn't. And it's very, very interesting because these people underneath these, you know, political elites, you know, back in Germany, they were so successful that, you know, there were no more Jews to kill. And the commandants and their soldiers, do you know where the Nazi elite sent them? They were sent to the Russian front or to the Balkans where, you know, almost certainly they would die.
Mm.
And the reason why they sent them to these very, very fierce areas is because these so-called potential witnesses, they wouldn't be around. They would be dead. And, you know, if Germany lost the war, which it did, they couldn't supply evidence.
You mentioned in your book on page 113 that all of this was muddled with faux intellectuals who blended genetics, anthropology, history, archaeology, astrology, mythology, and the occult. Is that how you look at this?
Yes, and one of the truly horrifying things is that, you know, it wasn't just German scientists. It was, you know, scientists all over the world. Even though they were very well-educated people, you know, they had their likes and dislikes.
Hmm.
And they didn't like minority groups, and so they looked for ways to prove that they were inferior. And keep in mind, there was absolutely no evidence to suggest that, you know, blacks were inferior to whites or Jews were inferior to Gentiles. You know, there was no proof for that. But, you know, these scientists, you know, they were always looking for such proof. And when their findings didn't correspond with their feelings, sometimes they would just put out fraudulent literature.
Mm.
And you know, these sorts of individuals, who believe that, you know, Gentile whites were the master race. These scientists lived in the United States, in England, in Canada. You know, so taken in that respect, you know, the German Holocaust wasn't really such a an aberration in history. I think that, you know, it was racism taken to its logical extremes. You know, like America and England and Spain, you know, they have groups that become the slave class.
Right. But how did they blend astrology and things like the occult to put this thing together? How did that play into it?
A lot of it was just ignorance.
Okay.
And a lot of these so-called German scientists, even if they were well-educated, they were also crackpots.
Okay.
You know, quacks, you know.
Okay. Because I was trying to figure out how did that play into, you know, what they did to the people. But I guess you can take anything and make an argument out of if you want to. And that's what it seems like. I'm like, astrology, the occult, with some of this. But I guess the occult, I can kind of understand how they put astrology and mythology and some of the other things. That didn't quite add up, but okay. Like,
sure.
It's, I guess you have to consider the source.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. And, you know, these Nazi scientists, I mean, they weren't acting as true scientists. If you believe that, you know, Jews or blacks are no better than bacteria, you know, if they're a sort of a vermin, if you can believe that, you know, you can believe just about anything. German science, it wasn't based on true science, which is why there was so much ignorance out there and so many, you know, outrageous ideas there.
Let me ask you this. The Holocaust, why do you think it lasted so long? I mean, I don't want to use the word allowed, but across the world, everyone pretty much knew what was going on. So why do you think no one stepped in any sooner to stop it?
Well, that's a complicated question, too. There's no easy answer for that. One problem was that, you know, the Allies as a whole, they felt like they were overtaxed. They had so many responsibilities. Their number one concern was defeating Nazi Germany. And, you know, saving the Jews and other so-called undesirables, you know, they felt like if they fought Nazi Germany and defeated it, then, you know, the Jews and the inmates, it would be to their benefit, you know, the sooner that they beat Nazi Germany. But, of course, since Germany was so powerful, you know, it took years for the Allies to finally defeat the Axis forces. And so by then, two-thirds of the Jews in not just Nazi Germany but throughout Europe are gone. But, you know, the Americans knew about it. Now, they didn't believe everything that was said about it. The Americans, the British, and the French, they never believed that millions of people were being gassed or that, you know, human fat was being turned into soap. They thought that was just propaganda. So when word came out about the camps, and what was going on there, you know, the Allies were just absolutely shocked. Sometimes they were so shocked and offended. There was one Nazi camp. It was Dachau. They liberated the camp, and the Nazis in this camp were so dedicated. Even when the end was near, they still stuck to their post. So these Nazi soldiers were there at the camp when the Americans came in, and they looked at how badly these inmates had been treated, and they just lined the Nazi soldiers into a line and just shut them all down. They even killed the dogs there.
Wow. Let me ask you this. Do you think we could have a repeat of the Holocaust?
Oh, absolutely. You know, back in 1945 when the the camps were discovered and documented, you know, groups of people, especially Jews, said never again, meaning that they would, you know, the worldwide community would never allow genocide to happen again. But, you know, it has happened. In the 70s, there was Cambodia. The communists who took control, they were very paranoid, and anybody who threatened them or people whom they perceived to be threats were placed into camps, often tortured and often killed. And virtually nothing was done to stop these people. And I think that as a result, I think it was about 2.5 to 3 million people. There was a genocide going in Rwanda. I think over the course of a year, about 800,000 people were killed. Basically, these were intertribal warfare. And, you know, there was clearly a genocide going on, but America did virtually nothing to stop it, and the UN did virtually nothing to stop it. There was also a genocide going on in the Balkans, and to his credit, Bill Clinton, he worked for the UN, and the genocide was stopped, which was a very good thing. But it says a lot that a lot of people in America did not approve of Clinton's actions, believing that it wasn't our concern. And genocides are supposedly going on in Tibet right now. The Chinese are bent on destroying Tibetan culture, and anybody who opposes them are either imprisoned or, you know, killed. And there's actually a genocide going on right now in the Sudan. Muslims there are killing Christians in enormous numbers. And again, the UN is doing virtually nothing to stop it, and America is doing virtually nothing to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. So let me tell the listeners something I found strange in the book. I found it strange that the Nazi SS did not want their soldiers to marry. Can you elaborate on what that whole thing was about, why they didn't want their soldiers to get married and have families?
Well, the German political elites, they wanted Germany to become a military empire. You know, they wanted Germany to be at war all the time. You know, they had a saying, you know, first Germany, tomorrow the world. You know, they wanted to be the conquerors of the world, and to do that, they needed many, many citizens. You know, they wanted many more boys to become soldiers, and the girls would grow up to be the mothers and wives of soldiers. And so Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, he actually strongly encouraged every SS man to father at least three children. And those SS men who did not do that, oftentimes they were denied promotions. And because they wanted to have so many children, Heinrich Himmler and other political elites actually tried to destroy the tradition of marriage. He wanted all German SS men to become promiscuous, having each one of them, you know, having intercourse with one woman, and then another, and then another, and then another, with the intention of each woman producing a child for him.
Wow. let me say something else I found strange in the book, that not many were prosecuted for what they had done. How is it that they were able to elude prosecution in some of these cases, the ones that the Nazi soldiers that had been involved in all this? How is it that they were able to elude the prosecution?
Well, there were many reasons for this. Lots of times, by the end of the war, people were so exhausted, they didn't really want to pursue justice. They just wanted to rebuild their lives. The Jews as community were like that. They didn't want to focus on, the victims of Nazi genocide. They wanted to get on with life. They wanted to go to America or to Israel, start their lives over and rebuild.
But some were for their crimes, though, correct? Some did get death sentences and things like that for what they had done, correct?
Yes. Happily, the political elite in Germany, many of them were brought to justice, which was a really good thing, and they were hanged. But just keep in mind, none of the Allies felt like they had the financial resources to go after all these Nazi criminals. So, I think they were about 880 executions of Nazi criminals, but compare that to something that went on in Babi Yar. Over the course of a weekend, 35 Jews are slaughtered. So we're talking about a very, very tiny group. Sometimes Nazis were imprisoned, but oftentimes their sentences were reduced, which personally I don't really understand. That's another mystery to me. I think basically everybody wanted to forget, at that time anyway. Anybody who had actually, the people in Europe who had been through so much, they just wanted to start life over. They didn't care about, trials or anything like that. Later that would happen. But, at Auschwitz, the commanders of Auschwitz were executed, but 90% of the personnel there, they never answered to their crimes. They literally got away with murder.
We're down to our last few minutes, Jonathan. Tell them how they can get your book.
You can find my book at Barnes & Noble, barnesandnoble.com, and amazon.com.
Give them again the name of the book.
Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites, and the Nazi SS.
Wow. Listen, for all of you all who have not read this book, I absolutely enjoyed it. I could not put it down at times. I told Jonathan I was just absolutely fascinated with the subject matter and the way he presented it. So I would tell each and every one of you all to go out, get the book, and you'll find it, I'm sure, as fascinating as I did. Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
It was my pleasure having you. Is there any other contact information you want to put out there? If someone wants to invite you to be on their show, how can they contact you?
You can reach me by Facebook or LinkedIn or Author Stan.
Spell your name for them.
Jonathan, that's Jonathan Maxwell, Maxwell.
Yes, and Jonathan is an excellent guest. As you say, he really knows his stuff on the Holocaust. And again, Jonathan, thank you so much for being my guest.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
It was my pleasure as well. To the audience, I've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And we thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
You too.